is the popular show with me, James A. Smith. We have returned to the condition of the pre-reform 19th century, characterized by vast disparities in power between the wealthy few and the assetless many. The left blame greedy corporations, and the right blame the meddling state. But the complex reality is that public authorities are part of the operation of private tyrannies today. This is Tyranny Inc., according to Sohrab Omari. He's the author of a new book of that name and the founding editor of Compact Magazine. This is the interview this podcast was made to do. I'm so happy to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me, James.
So the book's coming out. We're recording a couple of weeks before we're putting the episode out. It should be out, you know, as far as the listeners are concerned, tomorrow. Tell us about the endorsements, first of all, because this is the greatest political spectrum I've seen on the back of a book, I think, ever.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have a, you know, cross-partisan barrage of blurbs from, you know, figures on the left like Slavoj Žižek and Freddie DeBoer, and then on the right, you know, Senators Marco Rubio and Josh Hawley of the Republican Party, and then a few from harder to categorize figures like Michael Lind and John Gray.
It's a similar spectrum to that you've assembled to contribute to Compact Magazine in the last year or so. You've got Peter Hitchens in there from the British right. How did you sort of conceive those invitations? I know Lind has just joined your editorial board as well. What was your sort of strategy when you started inviting those sort of big names from across the spectrum to contribute to Compact?
Well, my co-founder Matthew Schmitz and I both come from the institutional right. I'm an alumnus of Rupert Murdoch's Dark Foundries, mm-hmm. the Journal and the New York Post. And Matthew worked for more than a decade at First Things, which is an ecumenical religious journal, quite prestigious here in the United States. But we both come from a place of frustration with the right. We are both, you know, Catholic, and like many others on the right, we decry various cultural phenomena like the opioid crisis, collapse in family formation, and so on and so forth. But what frustrated us about the right is that the right complains about these things as cultural phenomena, mm-hmm. but attempts to uncover the nexus between these kind of cultural phenomena and the shape of our material order, how we organize our economy and our class structure. And so we wanted to put forward found a publication where we explore both, we explore that nexus between material conditions and the shape of our culture. And so what that meant is, you know, broadening, you know, our masthead beyond what either of us was, you know, used to doing at our kind of former full-time jobs. So it did mean that, you know, we certainly bring interesting conservatives who are heterodox in various ways, like Christopher Caldwell or Peter Hitchens, who's written for us, for example, in support of the rail strikes in Britain.
Yeah.
But also it meant, you know, opening ourselves up to the kind of left tradition of political economy, it's broadly understood. And so it's been an exciting kind of project. A lot of people will say, oh man, I loved XYZ thing you ran, but then the following day, it made me very angry that you ran this other thing. And we don't agree with everything we're on either, but that's what makes it a very lively magazine. Leon Wieseltier, I think, once said that a good magazine should leave you kind of cross-eyed by the time you've finished reading it, and we'd sort of certainly strive for that.
Yeah, quite right. And I think that's a good ambition to have for a podcast as well. Ambition that you had for the magazine is really embodied in the book, and maybe we should jump into the argument itself. You quote Lincoln to the effect that there is no permanent conflict between employer and employed. And that's despite the fact that left-wing readers and right-wing readers will look at this book and think, well, a leftist could have said any number of the things here. That's is the kind of fundamental sort of cut between you and Marxism, and you are a man of the right, you're not a communist. But if Lincoln was right there, that there doesn't have to be a permanent conflict between employer and employed, what's intervened to create that conflict? Why is there such conflict?
Yeah, sure. I mean, to be clear, I quote Lincoln's famous address to the Wisconsin Agricultural Society, which he made when he was campaigning for president quite successfully, it turned out. I quote it as an emblematic statement of American political economy and a tragically wrong statement of American political economy. Problem was that Lincoln, for all his kind of visionary qualities and abilities as a practical statesman, he was a creature of a pre-industrial yeoman republic of an Arcadia in which it really was the case that the yeoman was both employer and employee. He was a sort of a montage or a combination of both figures. And so he largely worked for himself. If he did bargain with others, he did so at an arm's length. He could walk away from any deal and so on and so forth. That is not how the American economy unfolded, or I should say that's not how the industrial relations in the US or around the developed world unfolded once the Industrial Revolution happened. As Marxists well know, then you have economies of scale. You typically have a very few employers as buyers of labor power and very many workers as sellers of market of labor power. And the disparity in the number between the two means that workers are much more vulnerable. They're at the mercy of employers, all else being equal. Interesting enough, Adam Smith recognized this at some point in the Wealth of Nations. I think in book three, he says, you know, it's true that maybe both need each other, but on the whole, you know, the employer can subsist for maybe a year on his earnings, whereas the employee could barely subsist a day or a week at most. But Lincoln did not recognize this. He was an advocate of the ideology of free labor, which is the sort of Whig ideology, Whig in the American 19th century sense, of the worker and the employer as being more or less equal in power, and that he had this romantic idea that every worker was a capitalist in waiting, so that the penniless beginner in the world, he said, will start out with just nothing and then work his way, then he'll be able to afford his own tools, and then he'd be able to hire other penniless beginners, and those in turn would become capitalists in their own right. And so that's, of course, he was saying this just as the American economy was removing the tools from the reach of most workers. Most had to be, you know, you had the level of skill required in industrial production kept going down, and the complexity of the machine kept going up. So he didn't recognize this. And so for all his heroism in one sense in American history, I argue that he left a very flawed picture of political economy that had to be corrected finally in the New Deal.
The analysis that you make of the situation today, where the ordinary worker is kept permanently in this kind of assetless state, it's a very ambitious one. And if I can give a sort of sketch of the infrastructure that you describe that's keeping that inequality in place, its scope includes contract law, the courts, the dynamics of private equity, the privatization of American emergency services and medicine, and the death of media diversity, and especially local media. It strikes me that this is a book that's seeking what Marxists used to refer to as the totality of a class problem. Could you sort of talk us through the common thread that you see forming that totality between those different institutions and conventions?
Yeah, sure. Although I'm obviously not a political economist. I'm a journalist. So the way I try to grasp or glimpse that totality is by painting a picture of each of those elements of class power that you alluded to from the point of view of a kind of of a subject, of an individual, typically at the bottom of the labor market or the bottom rungs of the labor market, and how those people experience all these different institutions. And the thread is ultimately, the way I characterize it, is as a profusion of private coercion. So that's a very central concept to the book, that especially in the Anglo-American world, we're used to thinking of coercion as only what the government, or what the state, really, we should say, does to us. And in fact, we're faced with pervasive coercion in the marketplace, in our lives as workers and consumers. And so I sort of show instance after instance, although it's not, I mean, it's a short, relatively short journalistic book, but I show many facets of this kind of coercion. I mean, the most obvious is, which I begin with, is just growing precarity in the labor market, not just what we're used to of scheduling precarity, which has resulted in the fact that 40% of Americans would struggle to come up with $400 in cash to pay for an emergency, according to a study by the Federal Reserve. That's a product of wage precarity. There's also scheduling precarity in the sense that a lot of workers now are in the service sector, that's retail and restaurants and so forth, and increasingly they don't have any sense of what their schedule will be for the coming week. It didn't used to be this way. This is a relatively recent phenomenon where retailers and restaurants, et cetera, use algorithmic human resources programs to minutely schedule when they think demand will be high. And so the worker gets his or her schedule at the last minute. And there's often cancellation of shifts at the last minute, or what they call clopening shifts, which is the worker only shows up for the first 2 hours when the shop opens, then is supposed to go home, and then for the last 2 hours, those are periods of high demand. So that's a very kind of obvious kind of coercion. It's makes a chaos of ordinary people's lives. And to go back to your first question, again, conservatives are like, well, we have these kids who are distracted by phones, and they don't read, they're not developing the normal way, but they don't look at how mom's workplace schedule might be having a role. Yeah. And so on. I mean, there are much more complex ones, like the use of commercial arbitration in the workplace. Arbitration is a very ancient practice of, instead of going to court, you go to a neutral mediator to resolve your disputes, but it only works between parties of relatively equal bargaining power. But in the United States, in the past, since the 1980s, since the neoliberal era, really, that's been expanded to the workplace, where if you, let's say, are an Uber employee, and I tell stories of this kind, and you have a wage dispute, let's say you have claims for unpaid wages, you are required to go through mediation and arbitration, and sometimes the forum for this can be like in Amsterdam, and you have to be able to pay 20,000 euros up front to have your case heard. Before you get to actually litigate it. And this is for someone who might make $20,000 a year in total. So that's the thread, really, is the power of the assetless few to coerce the assetless many in ways that defy especially conservative conventions of what tyranny is or who can coerce and so on.
You say blackmail is illegal for a reason, and that sort of seems to summarize the problem in each of those areas that have been marshaled over the last 40 plus years, in order to reconceive what human beings and citizens are. You both people on the left and right, can't be nostalgic, as you say yourself, for the New Deal era, or in Europe the state managed capitalism, the Keynesian economics, and all that. Can't be straightforwardly nostalgic for it, but at least what you can say is that was a regime that, whether because it wanted to out of good nature or patriotism or whatever, or because it felt like it was being forced to because of unions and because of the existence of the Soviet Union, states kind of had to treat their citizens like human beings. Whereas what I come away from this book, and it's anecdotes about all these individuals whose lives are completely turned upside down by the institutions that you're describing, our current regime just sees people as resources to be completely exhausted, raided, speculated upon and then spat out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I rely from my, let's say, my theoretical lattice work, among others, on the political theorist Wendy Brown, who, in a very formidable way, describes the transition from the classically liberal state to the neoliberal state. You know, the classically liberal state, as someone like Carl Polanyi would teach us, is merely says, okay, we've coercively established market society, but then the market should be autonomous from other kind of concerns, leave the market alone as much as possible. Whereas the neoliberal state, as Brown, following Foucault, tells us, seeks to marketize the state itself so that kind of economistic modes of rationality pervade even areas of life where you don't expect them, so that even politics itself is articulated in the language of markets and profit. And if something is unprofitable, then therefore it's not a legitimate political claim. You know, she gives the example of this Supreme Court's ruling in Citizens United, which held that corporations have a quote unquote free speech right to spend as much as they please on political campaign here in the United States. And the language of the court is very much a market language, a market for ideas, the free circulation, et cetera. You could easily apply that kind of language to talk about, you know, the access that Exxon demands from some third world, developing world country. And that's how, that's the kind of, even the language itself of the Supreme Court takes on that same quality, and it makes no distinctions between, okay, someone is a single mom versus Exxon itself, as Wendy Brown points out. It treats them all as, okay, they're market participants and they should have equal access. So all these sort of terms that for us have these sort of democratic or humanistic valences in neoliberalism become just in sort of terms of market rationality. I give an example, which was recently reported by the New York Times in the book, that even hospital chaplains who are basically called by faith to accompany the dying in their final moments, the Times reported they're now at hospitals, the chaplains are rated according to these kind of productivity scores, as they call them, so that you know, they have to meet productivity scores. What does that mean in the context of a rabbi or a pastor or whatever who's spending time with someone in their final moments? But that's what we mean by homo economicus, replacement of homo economicus the supplanting of every other mode of being human by homo economicus.
Yeah, I mean, that's the basis of a very compelling conservative case for a much more interventionist form of economics, and also a broadly kind of left economic agenda that, well, defends treating people as people as opposed to resources. It's very easy today in political discussions to just sort of try to win the debate at hand, or at least to land some blows on your rivals and enemies in order to impress your own audience. That's a big kind of dynamic of the polarization that we have in political media today. But both in Compact and in this book, you are really kind of reaching out for new forms of coalition building. You remark in the book that the supreme challenge today is to forge a left-right consensus in favor of tackling the coercion inherent to markets. What are the impediments to forming such an alliance, in your opinion?
Well, I can only speak to it to an American context, but perhaps some elements would also resonate in other places, in other developed countries. But I think there are several. One is, on the right, even as the right has become more populist in rhetoric, I find that for the most part, the kind of Republican neo-populism that was heralded by Donald Trump's election hasn't really cashed out largely in terms of actual serious commitment to policy reform. In other words, you know, yes, Trump's tariffs, whatever you make of them, was a pretty important blow to kind of the neoliberal consensus that had taken root since the 1990s. And it's notable that his successor, his Democratic successor, has kept up the tariffs. And, you know, the National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan gave a speech not too long ago in which he decried the Washington consensus as a failure at home and abroad. But beyond that, you know, the Trump administration was filled with union busters. There was some hope there because something like the greatest share of union households had voted for him relative to Democrats since the Reagan era. But, you know, his Department of Labor was as awful as any Republican administration. So why is that? It's because the base of the Republican Party is not just distorted by the influence of a few sort of sociopathic billionaires, but the base of the party is a kind of, or the small-time rich. You know, the regional tire distributor is the kind of emblematic, goes to rubber chicken dinners and hails the self-made man, etc. That's actually a pretty, that's a class that's very resistant to the kind of reform that took root in the New Deal. It's the sort of least imaginative, and in some ways, I should use this word, most reactionary kind of. So I see a lot of noise about, you know, big tech, about monopoly, etc. I hear a lot of noise, I should say, from the right on this stuff, but then when it comes to policy, it doesn't go there. I argue in the book as well, though, that there, on the left, there is a somewhat parallel situation, though I think the crisis is worse on the right, but on the left, there is what Sarah Wagenknecht, the leader of the Left Party in Germany, calls lifestyle leftism, which is a kind of leftism of mores, of trying to lecture ordinary people about their consumer choices and the language they use in the workplace. Which of course is a great boon to the asset rich, because on the one hand, it's a kind of disciplinary mechanism. I think the insistence on vindicating ever more exotic identitarian concerns is a way to divide, you know, the asset less rather than finding a common ground, as Wagenknecht has called for. Moreover, beyond it being a disciplinary mechanism, it's also, first of all, it's obnoxious to a lot of voters, and they react accordingly. So I think those are two problems. By the way, it's also it's a great legitimating mechanism too for the for large corporations. I quote this instance of REI, which is a chain that sells outdoor gear. They recently had a podcast in which their chief diversity officer said, "Hello, I'm so-and-so, my pronouns are she, her, and I want to acknowledge that I come to you from the lands of the Ohlone people." So she made a the topic of the podcast was why the workers at REI shouldn't join a labor union.
Well, that's a classic example of the dynamic. Okay, well, I'll say this. I mean, the left has it coming as far as those critiques are concerned. What's interesting to me is that that critique of lifestyle leftism and woke capitalism and wokeness and all the hypocrisy, that's like a pretty major cottage industry in itself. And every other leftist has written a book attacking the left for doing that. What's interesting is how there are far fewer texts produced saying, you know, the same, like, here are the hard lessons that the right needs to get. You know, you got Listen Liberal, Listen Leftist. but what's fresh about this book is it actually feels like it's talking to the right. Of course, the left has a kind of autoimmune response whenever somebody who declares themselves to be on the right or just anywhere outside the kind of the sort of leftist chain of command, as soon as they start talking semi kind of leftist language, instead of saying thank you agree with us, this is great, people on the left will sort of bury around finding any reason to delegitimize the argument that's coming. So I guess you could probably expect something of that in the reviews to come. But what is
I should say, though, I mean, the Washington Post said it's it's an anomalously sensible book.
Anomalously, right? I see. they want to keep it an anomaly, no doubt. But yeah, I guess what I was getting at was you said at the start that the right will criticize, you know, bad cultural pathologies, will reach for an individualized explanation for why they happen, or, you know, a cultural one about bad ethnic groups or bad upbringing, et cetera, et cetera. It won't cut to the chase and identify the real cause for 98% of pathological problems that many people on the right and just most normal people will accept, you know, something is wrong here. The right is incredibly resistant to actually identifying that it is the force of the market that is incentivizing those problems. The left is very often the opposite to that. It's very happy to say it's against the market, notwithstanding the land acknowledgement in the the anti-union podcast. But then as soon as you start pointing to cultural effects that are obviously the result of precisely the capitalist system that the left is critiquing, they'll suddenly say, you can't say that. Immigration, when it's people coming from a country that's been wrecked by wars that the West has been intervening in, or has simply been made to be poorer than your country. Okay, people on the right, cultural conservatives, don't like the fact immigrants are coming in, but it's also palpably wrong that people feel like they have to leave their country and come and work for no money in your one. Sex work is another kind of classic example. Notwithstanding the existence of perfectly happy sex workers, the vast majority of people are in that situation because of a deeply awful exploitative world in which they're living, and they've been forced to sell their body in the most literal sense. But you sort of say any of those things, and you're accused of you're accused of playing into a conservative narrative that attacks these groups. So the right and left are always kind of looking past each other, and one has an analysis of the cause and the other has the analysis of the effect, and it's very difficult to bring people together on getting any kind of total argument. And this is a great step forward as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. I mean, coming from more than a decade on the sort of mainstream institutional right, beginning at the sort of ultra neoliberal editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal, including in London during the Brexit event, I'm much more critical of the right, as you know from the book as well. In other words, the book ends on a note that it's harder to move the right on these issues of material well-being. But there is as you noted, there's a sort of weird symbiosis between the two, especially now there's this sort of extremely grifty anti-woke culture that's emerged, right? Where it's the XYZ corporation would change its logo in tune with the latest sort of culturally liberal diktats du jour, and then online progressives will celebrate it or create controversy about it, and then the right will equally create controversy in response, and they both get reclicks and then retweets, I should say. Although now I don't know now that Twitter has been changed to X, I don't know what retweets are. Yeah. But the point is that very little is addressed having to do with corporate power, which I think, look, if you're worried about the ideological power of corporations, whatever the ideology may be, the easiest way to combat that is to raise up the countervailing power of working people. So that they have greater workplace autonomy, so that they're not fired for speaking their minds on the job or off the job, as often happens. And then, again, regardless of what the ideology is, that power, that form of coercion has been mitigated or ameliorated. And that's what we need to go for. And I will say, though, that again, when it comes to concrete policy proposals, I still find the best ones to be on the left and center left, right? So, like, here in the United States, the right complains about big tech power yet it's someone like Lina Khan, who's President Biden's competition czar, who has the most sort of serious proposals and investigations. The right will complain about Wall Street in this vague way of, you know, Wall Street, but it's someone like Senator Liz Warren, a Democrat, who has proposed a bill called the Wall Street Looting Act that would put a stop to a lot of the sort of predatory activities of hedge funds and private equity, where they take, you know, firms in the real economy that are working, and, you know, it's a familiar story of asset stripping it, you know, driving it to the ground, and basically siphoning all the assets into their own ledgers at the expense of workers and communities. And so, yes, there is this weird cultural symmetry, especially on Twitter, or the X app, as Elon would have us call it. But in a very discomforting way, I found that, you know, if you do look for concrete policy solutions to some of this stuff, it's largely the center left and the left that are still the only game in town and are serious about it.
It strikes me that the Republican Party machine failed to prevent Trump being the candidate in 2016 and did not expect to win with him. Meanwhile, the Democratic Party machinery, much more effective at keeping its outsider renegade figure down and kept Bernie out twice. But that slightly disguises the extent to which Trump, despite his presentational genius, did not deeply or meaningfully change the Republican Party, while Bernie, despite the fact that every effort has been made to make him and his popular style a kind of forgotten blip, actually, the Biden, I don't know if it is Biden, I don't know what goes on in what remains of his mind, the people around Biden, someone got it. Someone did understand Trump much more than your average Democratic voter. Somebody in there did understand Bernie much more than your average Democratic voter as well. And so there has been that kind of movement on policy. It's actually quite extraordinary what Biden is doing compared to what he was doing in the Obama years. And the Inflation Reduction Act and this kind of beginning of an industrial policy, if it was Bernie doing it, I have to admit, we'd be saying this is amazing. If it was Trump doing it, then in my more contrarian moments, I'd be telling people on the left, actually, this is great. So it's very difficult to give Biden any credit, but I'd have to agree that it does seem like people around the Democratic Party and kind of across the entire left half of it is not only Bernie, do seem to be the people who are kind of bringing this forward. At the same time, I wonder if the other side of your thesis about Tyranny, Inc. Presents a kind of complication here, because on the economics, it does seem like the Democratic Party is better than it's been for a really long time, as far as kind of rolling back some of this, you know, dreadful structural expropriation that we've seen for 40 years. On the other hand, when it comes to lowering the agency and power that ordinary people have, when it comes to expanding regimes of surveillance, censorship, when it comes to continuing to make foreign policy something that is outside the bounds of debate or democratic oversight, Biden's also been a massive step forward for tyranny on that other face. I wonder if you'd agree with that assessment, or you see any kind of conflict there in how politics is being managed.
I would say, especially on the foreign policy front, I have a deep agreement with you there. You know, as you pointed out, and as I've said, there is some basis for arguing that the Biden administration is the first post-neoliberal administration since the rise of neoliberalism under Carter, and then much more forcefully under Reagan and then Thatcher on the other side of the Atlantic. And you see this with the Inflation Reduction Act, with various moves to reshore manufacturing in the United States. Some of them are really inevitable in the sense that the pandemic revealed how these capillary supply chains spread across the globe were thin or too thin, and they snapped under the slightest pressure. And Americans of all parties and persuasions were suddenly alarmed to find that we couldn't manufacture anything, not masks, not personal protective equipment of other kinds, most basic ingredients of drugs. This all seemed outrageous. And suddenly the elite itself was confronted with the sort of the results of decades of asset stripping, of deregulation, of deunionization, of just sort of stripping its country of the country of its material base. And so there is, and the Biden administration remarkably absorbed this critique and ran with it, as you say. What worries me is that that might be also coupled with a kind of renewed extra hawkishness on foreign policy, which is especially alarming in that it comes after two decades of these failed regime change efforts and quote unquote democratization efforts in the Middle East and North Africa, which in the end created vast swaths of ungoverned territory and the migrant crisis that destabilized Europe roughly in 2015-16, so on and so forth. So to coming after that, to then suddenly go on a war footing against not just one, but two nuclear powers is a little bit alarming. And what worries me is that we're deeply in need of reconsolidation in the West and among the democracies to repair the damage that was done by neoliberalism. And I fear that a war over Taiwan, for example, would be an enormous distraction from something like that, let alone being, I mean, it would be a catastrophe in itself. But beyond that, you know, it would be another generation wasted on a war and not on this kind of reconsolidation of the domestic hearth, if you will. But then it raises the question, is the United States capable of doing things like industrial policy and, this kind of magical capacity for logistics that is unleashed by big business, big government, and big labor working together? Are we capable of doing that outside of a war footing and a martial mentality, right? So like now we're doing it, but it's with this mentality of, well, you know, there might be a war with China. And there are people who say, no, we shouldn't go to war with China because we have to go to war with Russia. And there are people who say, no, we shouldn't go to war with Russia because China. But either way, it's taken for granted that there has to be some war among the great powers. And so that's an area, and of course it's very much resistant to democratic deliberation, as you pointed out. And though I will say, look, I mean, supporting Ukraine to the hilt is just barely popular. I mean, if you just take, the polls change, but like roughly a majority supports the current policy. But as you know, it's very easy also to especially on these very distant issues, to manufacture consent, to use the phrase. So.
Yeah, it's enormously propagandized and in part for reasons you describe in the chapter on media and lack of media diversity. It's very hard for, you know, the little podcasts and the little publications that are covering anything that's happened in Ukraine prior to 2022. It's very hard to cut through. What about unions? This will be one of those things where the leftist autoimmune response will be leafing through this to find the page where you say that you don't like unions, and then probably throwing the book down in frustration when you say that you in fact do. This is a kind of classic example of, we've spoken to many conservatives on this show, including John Redwood, one of Margaret Thatcher's cabinet ministers, who will sort of talk the talk on this kind of bucolic ideal where everybody will work together and we'll have a productive economy where people aren't in kind of strife with each other. And then you say, well, yeah, but who's going to defend the interests of the vast majority of workers who don't have loads of money, are never going to have loads of money in your system, and will always have the deck stacked against them? So, I mean, do you feel like you're making the conservative case for unions, as has been done, or do you feel that you're just saying, this is something where actually the left was right and we just need that counterbalance?
No, I think the left was right on this count. I would just say that there have been... there have been figures on the right who, especially in the United States, who came to see and also in Europe as well, in the kind of Christian democratic tradition, that came to see the necessity of the of labor unions. I mean, you know, the New Deal was a project of progressives, yes, in part. It was as a result of a great deal of labor militancy, but it was also the result of some conservative elites who came to see that if they want to preserve the system in some ways, something has to give, and that something is to allow working people to mount countervailing power. You know, it worked brilliantly after World War II. Suddenly you went from single digit union density in the United States to a third of workers in the private economy being covered by a union. It also happened to be a period of great mass prosperity, et cetera. But I mean, there is a kind of simple case to be made that is, I think, purely economic, a case for unions in a way that I think could appeal to people on the right, I hope, maybe. And that's the one put forward by John Kenneth Galbraith, the great sort of, he was not a New Deal economist, but an observer and commentator on the New Deal, enormously influential in the mid-century period, but somewhat forgotten now. But Galbraith was no leftist. I mean, he was close to Democrats, but you couldn't call him, you know, a progressive in the same, he wasn't a Marxist or anything like that. But he argued that, look, in any situation where you have many sellers going up against very few buyers, which is a labor market, most labor markets, and especially when you have most markets being oligopolies, that is not necessarily monopolies, but oligopolies are ones in which that just two or three large actors dominate. In those conditions, the normal mechanism that's supposed to be the free market solution to everything, namely price competition, doesn't work because the few buyers of labor can more or less set whatever price they want for labor. And really the price of labor is not an index of supply and demand in those cases anymore, but it's an index of relative bargaining power. And if that's the case, then it follows that government has a role to help create competition, which he called countervailing power in this case, because it's not competition between sellers, but it's competition of sellers going up against buyers. So it's analogous to traditional competition. And just as even free marketeers are prepared to use antitrust power, government antitrust power, to break up abusive monopolies, so in this case, government has a role to allow workers to mount countervailing power through support of unionization. And again, it's strictly analogous to government creating competition. It's just not, you know, we think of competition as competition between sellers. Here, the competition is between sellers and buyers, and government helping one side of that. And that is the logic of the labor union, the pure economic logic of the labor union. And, obviously, I know progressives agree with that, but I see no reason why people on the right shouldn't be able to see that.
Another sort of, I don't know, I guess another kind of right-wing canard that you skewer in the book is how people on the right understand the phrase equality of outcome. This is something you always hear from commentators and influencers on the right to this day, that whoever it is, Bernie, Biden, Dylan Mulvaney herself, all of them don't believe in equality of opportunity. They believe in equality of outcome. Anyone faintly left-wing is secretly seeking this kind of communist uniformity where everyone has exactly the same amount, usually of not very much. You take that on. I don't know. I'd love to just get on tape your kind of take on that on that standard opposition that gets made.
No, what I argue is that at least in the American tradition, the original American ideal, the Jeffersonian ideal, is something like equality of outcomes. That at least the Jeffersonian strand of the American founding had set out to build a republic of modestly propertied yeomen of farmers, and therefore capable of republican self-government. And they were very much worried that if you have vast inequalities in wealth, that system would no longer work, because then you don't have people who are invested in the system because they don't have property. You have people who are very desperate, so they can fall into thrall to any demagogue that comes along. So, Jefferson said that government should do anything and everything it can to ensure that, quote, as few people as possible are without land, right? So this was a kind of very, that's a very egalitarian ideal if you think about it like that. That ideal was called often equality of opportunity, but as Christopher Lash argues in Revolt of the Elites, it didn't quite mean that, you know, the system is legitimate as long as a small number of the poor can rise up to great wealth or power. Rather, it's just that, as Lash puts it, the original American ideal is a little ownership for everyone. And in fact, the ideal of social mobility, and indeed the word, the phrase social mobility, didn't gain currency in American discourse until really beginning the late 19th century and then into the 20th. And that was just when the old Jeffersonian ideal had become more and more elusive for most people. And so then the elite discourse shifted toward what we now call equality of opportunity or social mobility, the idea that, you know, the system can't ensure a wide distribution of property, but it's legitimate if just a few people are able to, if the elite class is periodically refreshed by newcomers. And so in meritocracy, social mobility, all this stuff is the only thing I show in the book is, and I follow Lash here, is that it's just relatively new. It's not a deeply embedded tradition. It's a kind of fake tradition, such that a lot of Americans now think their founding ideals are sort of co-equal with the current model of meritocracy.
It's a crucial qualification and a really, really useful one. The other thing I'd throw in is it was around the, maybe it's even in Biden's inaugural address, I haven't re-listened to it, but there seemed to be a kind of overnight switch where suddenly the word equity was everywhere in liberal discourse. This was my perception anyway. And of course, the right sort of freaks out and says, don't you hear? They've stopped saying equality. They're saying equity now. That means that they want equality of outcome. Well, I mean, people are perfectly capable. You know, there are so many great critics of liberalism on the right. They're perfectly capable of recognizing what that actually was, which is just the sort of periodic reset on acceptable terminology that always happens in elite liberal culture to leave interlopers feeling like they're slightly behind the times or haven't got the right words. That's what that is. Also, just the idea that Joe Biden believes in equality of outcome is just such a hollow joke, given the actual political and economic changes that he personally has been in the room for over the decades. And just given how we've not been so far from equality of outcome since Thomas Jefferson's time, the sort of freaking out over this kind of fake meaning of equity or fake meaning of equality of outcome is another example of how the right can be as cringe as the left. When it wants to be. Well, look, good luck with the book. Friends have gone over it and are interested in it. Also, people on the left like to, you know, we like to draw blood once, I think. But I'm not interested in that. I just think it's fantastic. And I really hope people on the right are going to listen to the arguments that you're making. There are people across the political spectrum who are clear-sighted about the nature of the problems that we face and really the situation that our states are in right now is an intolerable one, and someone has to take it by the horns. So good luck with Tyranny, Inc. Sarah Bamari, thanks so much for joining us on The Popular Show.
Thank you. Very kind of you.